Steve, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. I'm really, really excited to talk to you. I appreciate your time. Welcome.
I'm happy to be here, Tim.
Okay, I need to start in a different place. I actually need to start by thanking you in a way. Years ago, you had a guest on your podcast, and I couldn't find the podcast, so I'm not going to get it completely right, but it was a woman who created an online course about, I think it was like at-home pregnancy or something about pregnancy.
Oh, yes.
I really can't remember. And I've been in the lead gen space and the agency space my whole life. For me, online business was always about making the phones ring and closing deals. And this whole idea of digital products seemed very elusive and intriguing to me. And after I heard that podcast and that woman and her husband, like I said, I couldn't find it. So I'll put it in the show
notes. Her
name's
Kim Campbell.
Kim Campbell. Cool. Yeah. Thank you so much. That woman and her husband were so honest about the fact that like they had no experience with this and it took them a couple iterations. And it was after that podcast that I actually went for it and I made my first course. And it's been pretty successful. I made like 50 grand from it. But if it weren't for listening to that podcast, I never would have gone for it. So I need to start off by saying that I appreciate your content and what you've done.
Dude, thanks for sharing that with me. That's awesome, actually. Yeah.
Cool. My pleasure. Okay. I want to dive right in, and I want to start at a place that I don't typically start at, but when speaking to you, I think it's important. I want to start with your origin story, because it's so intriguing. I'm sure you've gone through this story a bunch, and so I typically like to get into the meat and potatoes of it, but you've been so honest about your story, how you got started with your website, how you got started with mywifequitherjob.com. So please just inform the audience, inform the listeners how you got involved in this and how it happened in the first place.
I mean, I'll try to keep it short. Bottom line, when my wife became pregnant with our first child, she wanted to quit. And we live in the Silicon Valley, pretty expensive here. Pretty much need two incomes to get a good house and a good school district. And at the time, she was making six figures. So, you know, I kind of flipped out. And we looked for different ways to make money from home, and we just came across e-commerce, and we ended up launching an online store selling handkerchiefs. And it sounds random, but when we first got engaged to be married, my wife, she's just a crier. She cries at weddings all the time. We spent all this money on photography, so she didn't want to be seen in the photographs using Kleenex, you know, ratty Kleenex to dry her tears. So we looked all over for hankies. Finally found this factory in China that was only willing to sell us a couple hundred. And so we bought, you know, a couple hundred because they were super cheap. Used maybe a handful of them. And then we just kind of threw them up on eBay and they sold like hotcakes. And that's how we came up with the idea. So the e-commerce store was successful. We replaced her salary of $100,000+ in 1 year. And then my friends were like, hey, you know, I want to do something like this. I want to do e-com. So I was like, okay, I tell you what, let me just document this on a blog called My Wife Quit Her Job. And so I just started writing down my journey about e-commerce. None of my friends read it, but it did attract a whole bunch of random people who were interested in starting their own online store. So that led to a training class, led to a podcast, led to a YouTube channel, led to an annual e-commerce conference that I've been running for 7 or 8 years now. And yeah, here we are.
So cool. Congratulations. So do you still have, for anyone curious, it's called Bumblebee Linens. Do you still have that e-com company? Is that still
we
yours?
We do, actually. We just bought our own warehouse here earlier this year because we were just tired of California rents going up 30% every year.
Yeah. Congratulations. I know it's cool and like hot these days to start something and then flip it and cash out, right? But I actually am a lot more along the thought process of build and like hold it forever. And so I'm just always intrigued and encouraged when I see people like you that are building something and then, you know, continuing to maintain it and grow it over the years. So that's great. Congrats.
Thanks. I mean, the way I think about it is I could get like a 4x multiple, maybe 3 or 4x multiple. But if I just run this thing, because it's relatively low effort for another 3 years, I mean, why would I want to sell, right?
Yeah. I'm with you totally.
Yeah.
All right. When I think of you and your blog, I think of e-commerce. You've done more than that, obviously, but that's just the first thing that comes to mind. And You actually, you know, I put it up this morning. You had a tweet this morning, which I thought was like a perfect conversation starter. The tweet says, global e-commerce sales in 2022 were over $1 trillion, which is crazy. Want to make a million? You just need, okay, hold on, 0.0000001% of that. That's six O's. I've been intimidated by e-commerce. And to me, when I think of e-commerce, it seems like it's just so saturated and Amazon owns everything, right? So when you say that, do you think that there's actual room for e-commerce? And how would somebody get involved in there?
I mean, you should ask some e-commerce folks. Like I sell on both platforms. Amazon's pretty cutthroat. But with your store, you've got infinite freedom. And I think the key to success in e-commerce is really the repeat business part of it. And you can't really get that at Amazon. And we're just talking about your course, Tim. I think it's way harder to sell a course than it is to sell physical products, because when you sell a course, you have to have like an audience in order to do so. It's not necessarily true with physical products. Amazon owns 50% of e-commerce, but man, if all you want to do is make like a couple million dollars, we're not talking like $100 million or anything like that. I think e-commerce is a great way to go.
I actually would have expected Amazon to own more than 50% of e-commerce.
50% of U.S. commerce. Yeah.
Yeah. I love Shopify. And I think their CEO is really cool. Toby, he strikes me as just an honest, authentic person who's not afraid to be himself. Do you think that whole mission of, you know, arm the rebels, giving regular people, that's Shopify's motto, by the way, arm the rebels, like giving regular people the ability to start an e-com store. Do you think that has helped? And I guess what I'm asking is, do you think those individual stores will continue to be more and more of like the e-com landscape, or do you think Amazon will keep growing and gobbling it up?
It's a tough question. You know what made Shopify, and I don't know if this is 100% accurate, I just anecdotally, what made Shopify like take off is when they started promoting dropshipping, which sounds like a get-rich-quick scheme. And in many ways, it kind of is, because dropshipping is tough. Like, so for your audience who doesn't know what that is, this is where you take orders and someone else fulfills them. And you end up selling someone else's products. And I personally think that's like a dead-end business model. So I'm sure Shopify gets all these signups from tire kickers who never go anywhere. But that being said, if you want to do it right, have your own brand that you own. It's just like creating, it's essentially creating your own product. And I think that's where the longevity lies, not in all these get rich quick e-commerce schemes that you hear about on YouTube and Facebook.
You see a lot of them on Facebook, for sure.
Yeah.
Or on YouTube, I meant to say.
I mean, I think that's much the only way to go today for a long-term business is to own your brand. Because if you're, let's say you're dropshipping, or even if you're selling someone else's products, chances are it's on Amazon being sold by someone else for cheaper. Unless then it just becomes really a sourcing game, whether you can get the prices the lowest or negotiate the lowest prices, which is a game I wouldn't want to play.
Yeah, it's a race to the bottom game, as Seth Godin always says. I guess what I want to learn, I always approach these conversations as like, what do I want to get out of it? I approach them kind of selfishly. And the part about e-com that would have me stuck from the very beginning is, how do you even discover a product? Do you think you're best off if you have like a passion project? You know, let's say I'm a knitter and I've been knitting my whole life, and like, hey, somebody might actually want these. Or am I better off by doing some research and saying like, oh, look at this, there's an opportunity, there's growth in, I mean, I don't know, pickleball is like the new hot thing, right? So yeah. New pickleball rackets. So where am I better? Like, how would I approach that?
I think it just depends on a person's personality. I always say that if you have some sort of inherent advantage, take advantage of that. And that advantage could be you have a lot of knowledge on it, or you might have some connections. So I had a student who was asking me whether they should just use software tools and find something, or just sell products from India. And I was like, well, what products are India? And they're like, well, I got all these relatives there, and you know, some of them have been selling for a while and they sell some products. Should I bring those in the US? I'm like, yeah. I mean, you already have connections there. You have sourcing. You can probably get good pricing. So yeah, I would definitely take that route as opposed to using the tools. The problem with the tools is that everyone uses them, right? So once again, if you find something good from a tool, chances are a bunch of other people found that same item.
So you're telling me there's no easy way to do it?
Well, I'm saying if you want to start, then the advantage, just leverage all your advantages and really whatever it takes for you to follow through, right?
Yeah.
If you want to do something that you're interested in and you know you're not going to give up because you are interested in that, then I would say go for it. What ends up happening, and this is a problem that I face all the time teaching this stuff, is that people see some sort of video on YouTube promising riches in 3 months, and then 3 months passes and they haven't hit those riches and they give up. When in reality, it takes over a year, longer. You know, I mean, I've had students that make money within 3 months, but that's not the norm. The norm is, you know, a year at least, I would say.
Then what also happens is that person that makes money in 3 months, sometimes it's even harder for them because it was usually some kind of an anomaly. Not to say that they got totally lucky. Like, I'm sure they tried. Maybe they got lucky. Who knows? But it's uncommon, right? And so then you almost hit that, like, that encouragement peak too soon, only for it to come back down and get the even harsher realization of, damn, this is going to take some time and I'm going to have to like be consistent and put some work into this. You find that happens?
No, I think when people have early success, they're much more motivated. Like once you get that first sale, they're motivated and then they just go all out. They start launching a bunch of products, you know. Here's the thing about Amazon and you know, I get a lot of people who ask about Amazon because it's a huge platform. I think if you're just going to use the research tools and find something, you might be able to make some money, you know, early on here and there, but because it's such a competitive marketplace, it eventually will be a race to the bottom unless you can have your own brand, unless you create your own customer list and then sell to your repeat customers.
So the way I see it that's analogous is somebody... People ask me a lot about content businesses. I've been a writer my whole life. It just makes sense to me. And a lot of the things that I say is, yeah, start with like an affiliate site. It's not going to explode, but it'll give you a little bit of experience. You'll get a couple wins. And then once you have a couple affiliate sales, you can maybe book a deal with a wholesaler and sell physical products through somebody else's merchandising. And then once that happens, maybe you can create your own product, right? And so there's almost like levels and levels. Do you think that's analogous to what you do, where if you start with an FBA, you can get a little bit of experience and maybe turn that into a personalized brand and then maybe take that even a step further? Do you see it in terms of steps and ladders?
So the way I always teach it is if you have the budget for it, then start with private label or your own products. But a lot of people don't have the budget. So the way I teach it, if you don't have a budget, is to start out drop shipping or even affiliate marketing for Amazon, right?
Yeah,
and then you just look at, you have all the data, you pick your winners, start buying those items wholesale maybe in the beginning because it's a lower commitment. And then once you have enough data there, just private label your own version and drive traffic to your own product. So absolutely, it really just depends on the personality and the type of person I'm working with.
Yeah, cool. All right, let's switch gears a little bit here. You've done something which I think is great, where you built a media brand, let's call it a personal brand. I know some people don't like that, but let's just call it that. And you've also built businesses on the side, whereas your personal brand kind of turned into like documentation of that process. And I think that's really cool because we've all seen it where people's business becomes the idea of like, let me teach you how to sell courses about selling courses about selling courses. And it's just sort of like turtles all the way down, you know? But your journey was a little bit different where you started your blog, you documented your process, and you shared everything that you learned. I'm curious as to which of those routes do you find more fulfilling, more rewarding? Which one of them means more to you? Where do you spend the most time? Because you got a couple things going on.
Yeah. So the act of documentation isn't that fun to me. The fun part is actually interacting with people and that sort of thing. I mean, documenting everything, it's like writing documentation, right? I mean, it's not fun. It's a means to attract people to who are interested in what you're doing. I think the fun part is in the people that you interact with, that you're able to help, and it's really rewarding. Like, so I run an annual e-commerce conference called the Seller Summit. That's like my most fun part of the year because you've got a whole bunch of people coming in physically in the same location, and you can hang out and share war stories. So that's been the best part. So I find that aspect of my businesses more fulfilling than e-commerce, but I only teach everything that I actually do. So having the store is necessary, and e-commerce changes all the time. So that's what keeps me interested in that part of the business.
You naturally, I hear Seller Summit yearly conference and I get anxiety even just thinking about it. Right? And I know that's kind of a joke, but it's also not really a joke. Are you naturally more of a people person in that way?
You know, I used to be an electrical engineer, and the answer is no, actually. It's funny, ever since I started mywifequitherjob.com, I've started reading all these books on human psychology and interacting with people, and that's fascinated me. And I attribute a lot of my success from My Wife Quit Her Job from this book by Cialdini called Influence. And I think I've just naturally become a little bit more extroverted over time.
Anytime somebody brings up reading books on the podcast, I always take note of it because I'm very similar. I didn't go to school, and I've learned so much of what I know from reading other people's work, and especially books. You mentioned Influence. Are there any more books that have impacted you in a way that you think are worthy of making a note on?
I mean, all the standard ones, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yeah.
There's this book called Speed Reading People's Personalities that I enjoyed. It's basically, if you ask some questions in conversation, it basically gives you a profile of their Myers-Briggs. And then based on the answer to those questions, you can kind of adjust the way you respond to make them feel more comfortable. It's a pretty fascinating read.
Yeah, well, what was that called?
I can't remember the exact title, but it had speed reading, personality speed reading or something like that. Yeah, I can find it for you.
It's okay. I'll find it.
Yeah.
So what is it that you've accomplished so much? You've had your blog. I mean, geez, what's it been? 2007?
2009 is when it started.
Yeah, 2009. Yeah. So you've had your blog for so long. You've been working in this field for so long. I follow you on Twitter. You seem just as passionate about it as you've ever been. What's your mission with all this? Just keep teaching or do you have any like more plans in the future?
I mean, I'm just going down my bucket list. So what I did for this, every year I just do something different. So this year I launched my book, The Family First Entrepreneur, and my goal was to hit the Wall Street Journal bestseller list. Mission accomplished. Probably not going to do another book. The year before that, it was YouTube, and I grew that to over 250,000 subs. Just wanted to give video a try because I'm not really a video person in general. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to try this and see where it goes. Year before that, it was TikTok. The year before that, I mean, every year I have something, and that's what keeps me interested.
You know, and I'll make a note on that too, because as I was trying to come up with questions to talk to you, I was like, well, he's kind of everywhere. So like, you know, what do I focus on? Do I focus on this? Do I focus on social media? Do I focus on the blogging? For the purpose of this podcast, most of my listeners are writers. And so I usually try to keep it about websites. Most of your traffic, most of your audience and your email signups, let's say, still come from your website? Do you think that's been like the most valuable asset?
Okay, so the blog was the most valuable asset until YouTube.
Wow.
I feel like YouTube is worth more than the blog now. YouTube probably, it's neck and neck, actually. It switches every month. But in terms of email subs, YouTube and the blog are kind of neck and neck. And you would think that the blog would generate more email subs, right? But because you're right there on the site, you got pop-up forms and whatnot. But man, YouTube, just because Google's such a really good discovery engine, and all I do is I just mention in the video, hey, by the way, if you're interested in what I'm talking about, sign up for my free mini course, drive it over to the site. A lot of months, that gets more email subs now.
Okay. Hold on. this is blowing my head off real quick.
Yeah.
There's two things about YouTube that I've always been reluctant about. One of them is just like you said, there's not like a direct access point to an email sign up. So let me ask you like a couple of technical questions.
Sure.
Do you track how the email signups come from YouTube?
They like, have a special landing page. They have a special lander.
Okay. And do you put the link to that landing page in the description? Did you actually say it in the video and put the URL in the video?
All I do is point downwards, look in the description. I don't mention the URL in the video because anecdotally I heard that's not good. So I literally just point and it's right there, the first in the description, and I posted it the first comment also and pin it.
Wow. This is just taking me back a little bit because I've wanted to get into YouTube. You know, I moved to Denver recently. I kind of set up a little bit of a studio for this podcast, and I've continuously gone back and forth in my head, like, yeah, if I want to be a YouTuber, then I should spend more time on YouTube. But I like writing, I like newsletters, I like email. And so my priority was always, let me focus on the blog, get as much traffic as possible. And you're, so when did that start happening?
I've been on YouTube for 4 years now, taking it seriously.
Yeah.
And then I just joined all these mastermind groups. This will blow you away. YouTube, just the AdSense revenue, generates between, I'd say, $20,000 to $30,000 a month.
On 250,000 subscribers?
Yes.
Yeah, that is blowing me away.
But let's talk about the blog real quick. I mean, the blog is very important to me because it's the home base, right? And I spent a lot of time optimizing my posts for SEO. And I don't know if your listeners are going to not like hearing this, but I actually used to enjoy writing a lot. And then when I started writing for SEO, it basically sucked all the joy out of writing because Google just wants the answer to the question. It doesn't want to hear your anecdotes. It doesn't want to hear anything that makes the post interesting and that could actually hurt you, right? I don't know if you've had the same experience, Tim.
Totally. So my SEO agency, I don't mind telling you, I got sober like a little more than 10 years ago. And I started a blog called Sober Nation. It's basically like a giant resource center for people in recovery. And through that, I learned the whole idea of content marketing. And I didn't think of SEO at all. I was just writing. And so it grew organically. And then as I grew my agency, we work in the behavioral healthcare space. And so it's a little bit more technical when people are looking for services. And the writing isn't as creative because when people are looking for services, they're not actually looking for anecdotes. They're just looking for, like, can you solve my problem? And so after doing that for so long, it crushed me. And I had to really take a step back. And I still own the agency. And obviously, I've scaled it out with employees. So I don't have to do the writing so much anymore. But it's something that concerns me. Whereas where is the... It's not just the creative writing, like where's the experience go when all we can write for is to solve that initial problem? Do you think about that at all?
I do, and I have the solution. So, Tim, I write to attract the lead in the blog using the boring writing, and then my personality comes out on YouTube in the podcast. So I embed every YouTube video I make into a post. And what's beautiful then is that you can rank the video and the post for the same search term in the search results.
So you're SEOing it on two fronts. One of them is technical and one of them is, let's just say, creative. I know that doesn't quite totally nail what we're saying, but one of them is creative.
Yeah. Yeah. Because a YouTube video is much more forgivable. I mean, you can talk about anything, right? That's why I like YouTube. That's why I came to love YouTube better. Because I'm not constrained by what I can put out.
And do you think YouTube is going to be more and more where you spend your time as time goes on?
I mean, we can have a whole discussion on this, but yeah, because AI, a lot of people I know are already mixing AI with their content. It's just going to be this big spam fest. AI for video, I think there's still a ways for that. And then people are always going to want to be able to see and hear, you know, the person on video. Whereas writing, it's a little too easy to outsource to a machine, I think.
I think that makes a lot of sense, obviously from a technical standpoint, but I wonder a lot about the things that are valuable are always the things that are most in demand that not everybody can get, right? It's just simple supply and demand. And the demand for me is always going to be limited because there's only one of me, right? Whereas the demand to write stuff with my name on it, that's a little bit different. I don't actually ghostwrite myself, but with AI, like, you have the potential to. It's pretty easy. You can put 60 articles out in an hour if you wanted to. And so I wonder if the demand for personalization and engagement and let's just call it connection will actually go up as a result of AI, and maybe platforms like YouTube and, I mean, geez, even like conferences, like you said, maybe that's where the next opening is going to be.
I think and hope that's the case. With writing, who knows what's going to happen? I mean, it's not easy to search for that stuff.
What?
You know? And so it'll be curious how Google deals with that sort of content. It's much easier to just deliver an answer to a question from Google's perspective, from a technical standpoint. When you have to parse opinions and that sort of thing, I don't know, who knows? But yes, this is why I think video and audio is going to be where it's going to be at. I mean, it's already gone that way in a long time. It's actually gone to short form content, which I kind of detest, but you know, everyone's attention span is getting shorter and shorter. When I wrote my book, I just came to realize that people don't read anymore. So to hit that bestseller list, like, I had to try hard to sell the book. And a lot of times I didn't sell the book, I sold the bonuses. So you buy the book, you get the bonuses, because, you know, people don't have the patience to read long form anymore. It's kind of where the world's going.
It's always surprising to me. Yeah. I love reading. It's always surprising to me. I spend at least an hour a day reading.
Yeah, but I mean, the younger generation, let's just say.
Yeah, kids
these
days,
you look pretty young,
right?
Actually. You look pretty young.
I'm 37.
Now. Okay, yeah. So you're not that generation. Really.
I'm borderline. I'm like the most typical millennial that there is, although I don't think I'm entitled. Wow, there's so many questions I have about YouTube. I've never taken it too seriously. And what intrigued me about your story is that you said you're not naturally a video person. And so how, I'm not either, by the way. I could be recording a video by myself in this office. No one will even be home. I wait until my kids and my wife leaves the house because I get so like anxious about it. And it's just me. And I still feel so anxious in front of the camera. So how did you get to a point where your content was professional and you could produce it in a way that people took seriously, that you could repeat? Do you have any tips for that?
Okay, so my number one tip is to get a teleprompter.
Well, really?
Makes pumping out videos a breeze. I don't even worry about it anymore. The other tip I have is to just start going live. No one cares, and then that way you can't like turn off the camera and go, wait, let me start over again. Can't do that when you're live, right? We're filming this podcast right now. I suppose I could say, hey, stop, can I refilm that? But I'm not going to. And so you get used to just talking off the cuff, and that makes things a whole lot easier. It takes practice.
Yeah, but it's the good kind of practice because. Yeah. Like, you're in the game, right? A teleprompter. Hold on. I'm so surprised to hear you say that. Do you write your videos out before you record them? You write the script?
Sometimes I write the script. Sometimes it's just bullet points that I advance so I can stay on track. But it allows me to film like a 10-minute video in like 20 minutes or less.
Well, yeah. What a great piece of advice. I am definitely going to get a teleprompter. So thank you for that. All right. And then, last question on YouTube. What do you think is the frequency that you've had the most success with? Do you think like one 7 or 8 minute video a week? Do you think a video every day? What's worked for you?
For me, it's not necessarily what's worked for me. It's what I have the capacity to create while still maintaining a good lifestyle, right? For me, I think at least one video per week, same time every week. I'm usually good with between 10 and 15 minutes on the video. And here's the thing about video also. It always starts from a blog post. Right. So my blog is still the core of the content. And what happens is I take that blog post, and you can't just read the blog post, obviously, otherwise you're going to bore the person to death. But I just take that blog post. Sometimes I use AI to spruce it up and make it YouTube ready. And usually that involves cutting down a lot of stuff. And that's what makes everything streamlined. So I repurpose everything. So it starts with a blog post, create the YouTube video. And there's this new AI tool that I've been using called Opus that breaks apart the YouTube video into short clips that I can post. Wow. So, you know, it's been good.
Opus was like the first time where I saw something and it actually made me go like, oh, wow, all these people are screwed. You know, like there's no such thing as a clip editor anymore. It just was instantly gone. So yeah, Opus is pretty clutch. All right, let's bring this thing home with talking about your book, The Family First Entrepreneur. What a great title. Two questions, and I guess this is just an open-ended question. Feel free to talk about it as you will. But why write a book, and what's the book about?
Why write a book? I asked myself the same question.
Yeah.
It has always been on my bucket list to take my kids to the bookstore and see it on the shelf. The other reason why is because my mom has never read anything that I've ever done. She doesn't understand what we do. She doesn't understand blogging. She doesn't understand e-commerce. But she does understand the book. So when I told her about the book, she was like, oh my God, that's so awesome. It's in Barnes & Noble's. Oh, you hit the bestsellers. I read the Wall Street Journal. So I got some street cred there. What was the second question? What's the book about?
Yeah, okay. Like, what'd you write about?
So what I found was that most of the business advice out there is given by single dudes who can work 80, 90 hours a week because they have no responsibilities. That was not representative of my life. I had two kids. I can't just work 80, 100-hour weeks because I actually want to see my kids and I want to see my wife. So I wrote the book because I felt like there's like this huge need for people like me out there to receive business advice, not from just some single dude with no responsibilities. So it's really about balancing business with family and not getting too carried away with the business stuff, which is very easy to do.
I wish I would have started off with this question now, because this hits really close to home. I'm a little bit in between. Like I said, I'm 37. I had kids a little bit later. So I had my son, he's 2.5 now, a little more than 2.5. I don't think I would be where I'm at now if I didn't have those 10 years to basically punt everything down the road and just be like, I'm not worrying about that right now. My job is to make as many sales as possible and lift, like stay in shape. And that's really all I did for 10 years. So I still work pretty hard and life is different now. Believe me, I'm sure you know, like it is not the same as it was. But what a concept. It was one of the things I train Muay Thai every week, and one of my training partners, he's 23, and I send him videos about my son like screaming and yelling and stuff, and we have a good time. And I find myself being that guy now where it's like, it's not that I don't want to hang out with you on Saturday night and watch UFC fights. It's just like, it's actually not a possible thing. And I know that doesn't make any sense to you right now, but it's not a possible thing for me to do. And so the ability to have that extra time taken away is a huge turning point in my life. And like, I really mean that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's funny. I was looking for books about that, but there aren't, certainly not a guy. There are women who've written books like that actually, but not very many men.
Yeah. So what are some of the strategies then? Do you call them strategies? Is it more concepts?
Not
is
really
it just
strategies.
Ways of
it's,
thinking?
It's concepts. So one thing I'll share with your listeners is, have you ever heard of the four burners theory?
No, never.
It's basically that your life is dictated by four burners. So you have your family burner, your work burner, your friends burner, and your health burner.
Oh, yeah. James wrote a blog about that.
James Clear
years
wrote
it.
Yeah, exactly. That's where I credit him in the book for it. Cool. You know, if you turn off one of the, in order to do any one thing well, you have to turn off at least one burner. If you want to do it really well, you have to turn off two. And if you're Elon Musk, you turn off three and work is all you do, right? It's basically a theory that talks about priorities in your life. So for me, my burners that I prioritize are mainly family and health. And work is tied with health, I would say, because you can't have it all. You got to make sacrifices. When we first started our business and we started seeing some success, and maybe you can reflect on this too, Tim, but like this fever overcame me and all of a sudden all I wanted to do was just scale the business no matter what.
Yeah.
So I would set these income goals and then we'd work hard to hit them. And then for the next year, I'd move the goalposts. And I kept doing that. We were already making way more than we spent because I'm a pretty cheap guy. We don't really spend that much money.
Yeah, me too.
And my wife came and she's like, I don't want to do this anymore. This isn't fun. Sure, we're making all this money, but we don't even spend half of it. And yet we're killing ourselves to make more money. And it was at that point I was like, hey, you know what? You're right. Why am I doing this? This is all about ego, right? Because I belong to mastermind groups and we always share revenue and what's working and whatnot. But meanwhile, I was driving our relationship apart, right? So I kind of lost track of why we started the business in the first place. And correct me if I'm wrong, I've done this survey with a bunch of my friends before. Most of us get started in business just so we can have some freedom. It's not necessarily to start the next big company, right? Just want to be free to do what we want to do and hang out with who we want to do. And if that is your goal, you got to remember that and kind of adjust yourself and your life appropriately, because four burners theory, you can't have it all.
Read the book Principles by Ray Dalio?
I have not. It's actually on my list. It's a little intimidating for me.
Yeah, it was a pretty good book. It could have been like a third of the length, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
I hardly remember any of it, but it's kind of one of those things where if you pull away one good lesson from a book, it was worth reading. And the lesson that he had in that book that always stuck with me is you can have anything you want, but you can't have everything you want. And when I read that, I was still living in Florida at the time. It really helped me with, you said ego. It's an ego thing more than anything. It's just the coming to the realization that there's only a certain amount of time in the day. You're going to be dead at some point. Like, what do I want to do with the time that I have? Because you can choose something and say, like, this is what I want to do, but you can't do it all. And when I learned that lesson, that was actually really, really, my anxiety went down, my happiness went up, my relationship with my wife and my family got even better. So I totally agree. I think that's like a noble topic to write about. And there aren't a lot of books about that tailored to men at all.
Yeah. The books I read, written by men, are about scale, scale, scale.
You know.
Scale some. Hey, useful, right? I mean, for business, if that's your goal, right?
I guess so. It does make me think a lot about that idea of what you were saying. I've definitely had that conversation before. I mean, I do better in my life than I ever thought I would. And when do you decide, like, okay, I'm at the next phase in my life round? So let me ask that personally to you. Like, was there a moment where you said, okay, this part is over. Let me move to this next phase where my priorities shift a little bit?
It's not like how you say it. It's not like all of a sudden you're in a different phase, right? I mean, my priorities have not really changed over the years. It's just I've gotten carried away with certain things.
You mean?
Right? I mean, the reason why we started Bumblebee Linens, not because I have some passion for hankies. It was really just so my wife could stay at home. And then I wanted to stay at home. And that became my wife quit her job.com's purpose. And then it happened. And then once it happens, you're like, you have these friends. So I belong to this group at Stanford called the Mayfield Fellows Group, Mayfield Fellows Program. They take kids, and every year we go on this retreat. And the goal of that program is to get you a VC-funded startup and exit for $1 billion. I mean, that's literally the goal of the program. And so every time I go to these retreats, there's everyone. Kevin Systrom of Instagram is a member of that group, just to give you an example. I go to these meetups, and then all my buddies here are having these huge exits, and then it comes to me and I'm like, yeah, I'm still selling handkerchiefs, I'm still blogging. Makes me feel bad in a way, right? Because
yeah,
so it's really just about figuring out what matters to you and then sticking to your guns. And I don't know about you, Tim, but I always want to be, like, I have an ego. Like, I always want to be doing things. And so that's why I came up with that one year a thing philosophy. Every year I just focus on one thing, learn as much as I can about it. And that's been enough to satisfy the ego. Like this book, for example, that I launched this year, that satisfied my ego for the year, right? I'm going to move on.
Ego aside, though, in just a short conversation, you strike me as somebody that seems like you kind of figured out who you are a little bit, and you're feeling good about the place that you are in life. Is that a total wrong assumption, or are you feeling content these days?
I'm feeling pretty good, right? I mean, I can do what I want. I can hang out with who I want. But again, I'm an old Chinese man now, so I've made plenty of mistakes. You know, the story that I just shared with you earlier about just trying to go for too much for no reason, really.
Yeah. It's amazing, Steve. I never know what I'm in for with these conversations. I'm grateful that you were vulnerable enough to talk about some of these more personal lessons that you've learned and not just be like, yeah, more views, do it this way, do it this way. So I really, really appreciate it. I appreciate your time. Okay, I'll wrap this thing up. You're on Twitter, mywifequitherjob.com, and then your YouTube channel, is it called My Wife Quit Her Job?
It is, yep. Use the same name for everything. That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. Is there anything else that you'd want to say before we sign off?
I mean, if you guys want to check out the book, it's called The Family First Entrepreneur. You can get it at any bookstore, Amazon, whatnot. And the only last thing I'd say is if you guys are getting married, I'll hook you up with some handkerchiefs over at bumblebeelinens.com.
Nice. Yeah, excellent, man. I really appreciate your time. It was a thrill to talk to you. I certainly have looked up to your work for years, and it's always good to know that people are just people, you know, and like you meet people on the podcast, it's like, oh, it's just a regular person like me, so... So that's great. I enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much.
Cool. Thanks for having me, Tim.